Love Sport Radio. On digital radio, online, mobile, and smart speaker. This is Upfront on Love Sport.
This is the James Gray Show podcast edition. Please do leave us a rating or a review wherever you get your podcasts. And remember, you can tune into the show every weekday from 1 p.m. until 3:30 p.m. on Love Sport Radio.
This is Love Sport.
Aston Villa going through last night on penalties. Albert Doma missed, by the way, for Villa, missed badly. Slung it over the bar. It was a really dreadful penalty, but it didn't matter because Villa, fortunately, had Jed Steering goal, and he saved two penalties to ensure that they will go through to the playoff final at Wembley. Now, on the line to talk a little bit about the psychology of penalties, because I think it is a psychological challenge, it's Stephen Sylvester, sports psychologist. Try saying that quickly, Stephen.
Hi, James.
Hi, Stephen. Tell me a little bit about the difficulty. You know, a lot of people talk about the long walk to the penalty spot and all different things, and then you get fans on Twitter or even in the stadium saying, oh, you're a professional footballer, it's just 12 yards, just bang it in. Why do penalties have such a hold over us?
That's the million-dollar question, James. I think the reason being is there's lots of moving parts. The first thing to say, it's not a football issue. I haven't met or played with or worked with a footballer that couldn't score from 12 yards. So your Twitter fans are absolutely correct. There isn't a professional footballer that doesn't practice that has done it from childhood right the way in the back garden to the local football team, to the school team, and then into professional football. You can all strike a ball with exquisite timing and with exquisite desire. So something is happening, and I think it's the mix of the demand of the situation, the prize and the expectation at the end of it, the whole kind of context of the crowd, and all these moving parts build up in a particular player's head, and it's about whether that player can tolerate that amount of demand.
So when you've worked with players and you know, for example, Dean Smith mentioned last night that as soon as they knew they were in the playoffs, they started working on penalties. In your experience, from a sports psychology point of view, what sort of preparation do you do with players to try and get over that speed bump of penalties?
Yeah, that's a great question, James. I mean, you can practice it, but I don't think practice effects has any influence on the ability to put the ball down, to stay calm and collected, and to execute the skill. I think my work would revolve around talking to the players and trying to monitor how much belief they have in their attributes to deal with the demands and deal with the technique at the same time. So I might say to a player, okay, so you're a selected player for the penalty kicks. Tell me, what's your process? And they might say, well, I look at the keeper. Generally, I go to the left to the keeper, but if he's moving, I might go straight down the middle. But really, I've got two places, but I'm going to commit to going left bottom corner. And they talk through their process. If you look at Sterling, where Sterling scored the winning penalty in the League Cup final, he was very clear. You know, the players around him were building up. He was building, so I'm not going to miss this. I am going hard and I'm going to go for the top corner and I'm absolutely going to win this for our team. And so you either get a player that becomes excited by the opportunity and sees the joy in it, or conversely, you get a player that just sees the fear in it. And their rhythm is affected, which you see in their walk. Their eyes look different because they're fairly stressed. They kind of don't want to be selected. So on the training ground, they're the last to take the penalty kick. Mm. They're the ones that you know, are not putting their arms up first to actually take the kick. It just depends on their own formula and their background and what that demand places on them. For some, it's too high. For others, they're capable of working it through. And it just depends on what your particular history is and your mix and how you really see the situation.
So if a player comes to you and says, look, I should be a good penalty taker. The gaffer thinks I can take penalties, but I have no process. I don't have a reliable routine. And he says to you, I want to build that. obviously it is different from player to player, but what are the basic concepts you're relying on there? Is it just about having a repeatable psychological routine?
Yeah, it is eventually, but I think before you get to the routine, firstly, if a player came to me with those ideas, I'd say brilliant. It's the first step because you're at least being willing and committed to looking at it differently. So let's take Paul Ince, who played for 5 top clubs, captained his country, did everything, never took a penalty kick in a major final, didn't want to do it. Now, if he came to me, I'd say, Paul, come on, you know you can do it because technically you're one of the best in the team. You're a strong man. You've won trophy after trophy in the biggest clubs in Europe. What's the issue? And it would be a delight to talk through his fear about what it places him under, taking a kick. So I think it's that talk to begin with, that shared conversation where you're talking about, is it that underlies your feeling behind taking this penalty kick? And so I'd explore that first. And then as that progressed, the player would naturally think about the execution of the task. And don't forget, penalty kick, they do that kind of rhythm of ball strike every single day of their lives. So it's not a big deal.
Do you think it matters whether they take it first or second? Can you send a message by choosing to take penalties first and say, yeah, we're that confident we'll go first?
Yeah, I think you do see a message. The most confident players take them first and score them generally. Because they believe that it's only 12 right. They minimise the importance of the kick. So we need this to get through to win, but it's not important. Importance is, like Sterling said after he scored, the important element is putting this in the top corner. And if you watch the kick, it literally hit the underside of the crossbar and went into the top corner.
Yeah.
It was impossible for the keeper to save it. And in his mind, walking to it, he had the fervour of, I'm number 5 and I'm going to win it for my club. If you look last night, they had the majority. West Brom had a defensive outlook to the two games. They had defensive players putting their hands up to take the kicks. And as a result of that, they didn't have the momentum going into the penalty kicks. Whereas Aston Villa, you know, had a brilliant run to get into the playoffs and, you know, probably felt they should have actually won the tie across the two legs. And so had a lot more positive momentum going into the penalty kicks. And don't forget, they've been practicing it. Of course, they have to hold on to something practical that says, if we've been putting some amount of hours of practice in, then surely we should get a positive result. Now, and that's fine, but you know, the context of the situation, you know, Gareth Southgate might feel, well, I practiced my penalty kicks, but I still missed them in the Euro 96.
Yeah. Do you think players, just finally, Stephen, do you think players are better now at having that conversation? You said the first step is acknowledging that you maybe need to think about things a different way. Do you think the modern footballer, even compared to, say, 5 years ago, is better at acknowledging that maybe talking about it will make a difference?
I absolutely think that that's the case. And as we mature and become a lot more modernised in our thinking, and we see the role of psychology to be helpful, to be supportive, and actually it's pretty special just to have the most simplest of conversations, I think that more and more people will be open to it. And I'm finding in my work in football that once you open that sort of world of thinking, I get players just being more and more open because they understand that there's nothing better than getting a supportive view of a problem that they're encountering. And surely, if that's good enough for footballers doing something exposed in the public eye, then it's good enough for every human being that we need to share more. We need more community. We need to get the players feeling more comfortable. So from last night, my observation is clearly that the Aston Villa players felt more comfortable about taking the penalty kick than the West Bromwich Albion players because we saw it in the flow of the techniques.
Stephen, thank you so much for that insight. Really good to have someone who knows what they're talking about. Stephen Sylvester there, sports psychologist. There you go. I got my way around that tongue twister. Second time out. Of course, that is penalties, isn't it? It's not a difficult skill. It's an easy skill if you're a professional footballer, but you've got to think about it the right way.
Love Sport.
Joined in the studio by Love Sport's very own Guy Watts. Talk a little bit of cricket because England chased down yet another mammoth total yesterday. I wonder if there is a total England can't chase down, Guy.
I'm not sure there is. I'm yet to see it, really. I think it's pretty ominous for the opposition, really, whether it's Pakistan or one of the teams that are considered more of an obvious favourite for the World Cup. Pakistan, though, you've got to remember, are one of those teams. I don't want to compare them to Germany in football because they're not quite a superpower in that same way, but they do peak at major tournaments a lot more often than not. Of course, they won the Champions Trophy back in 2017, knocking England out along the way. It was in England, of course, although actually the semi-final where we lost them was in Cardiff. These guys are contenders. They're no mugs. They may not have the budget or the resources that, say, England and Australia and India do, but they are a really proper team. So to knock off 360 so casually as we did means something. It's not like doing the same against Ireland, although ironically we made a bit of a meal of chasing down a lot less against Ireland a couple of weeks ago. So it was another vote of confidence, if you like, in this England team, who had of course rested their best player Joss Butler and their most dangerous wicket taking spinner Adil Rashid.
Do you think there's also something to be said that small ground, flat deck, sunny day, is this a little bit of this is to kind of take the sheen off it? Someone's saying, this is what the World Cup's going to be like. It's going to be tedious. Is there a danger of that? That actually they go, oh, we want flat decks and loads of runs?
I'd say two things in response to that. I'd say, one, it's too simplistic to say that. Bristol is going to be one of the World Cup venues, but there are lots of different venues being used. And yes, some of them, like Bristol and Trent Bridge in particular, are slightly bowler's graveyard-ish. They're short boundaries, they're good batting tracks. We're going to see lots and lots of runs, and people do want to see that, although it can become tedious at a point. But it's not going to be the case at every single ground. And the other side of it, which is slightly more ominous from an England perspective, given what happened 2 years ago in Cardiff against Pakistan in the Champions Trophy semi-final, is that the pitches will deteriorate. These ICC competitions have the pitches governed, if you like, by the ICC. They don't use new pitches for every game. They will use same pitches. They therefore will deteriorate. And it was that sort of slightly used, slightly lifeless pitch, if you will, in Cardiff a couple of years ago that proved England's undoing. Bowled out for just 211. That really is the big albatross around the neck of this current team. We know how many times England teams have failed at World Cups in the past. Essentially, all of them there have ever been. It was that 2017 Champions Trophy that was really a black mark against this team, because it suggested that maybe, however good they were in all the other series, they hadn't quite shaken off the ability to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory at the moment when it mattered most.
We're now just over a week away from England naming their final World Cup squad. Of course, their preliminary squad, we already know, will not be their final one because Alex Hales has been removed from it. We also think they're going to lose one more because James Vince, it seems, has, despite the fact that England won't pick him, confirmed his place in that preliminary squad. It's the bowlers we're talking about now because Jofra Archer, I think, has worked his way into the squad. Again,
he's worked his way into the team, James.
By the virtue of the fact that they haven't picked him yesterday. They basically said, no, we've seen quite enough of that. It's like buying a supercar and then saying, well, I'm not going to drive it. Obviously, I'm not going to drive it.
There's a great irony. Sorry, I know we want to go into a wider chat about the bowlers, but with Jofra Archer, it was that four-over spell. It was in the first game of the series, the one that was rained off at the Oval, and he absolutely lit up. Four overs worth. I know the conditions were bowler friendly, but it's four overs and he only went for six runs. Four of those came from a boundary on the final ball of that fourth over. In 3.5 overs, he'd gone for two runs. He'd taken a wicket and quite frankly could have taken a couple more. And the irony being that four overs is the amount he's, you know, used to bowling in 2020 games. He's only played 16 List A games, you know, first class 50 over games in his career. It's actually a very small number. The only concern would be this guy has not bowled that many 10 over spells. I'm not going to say that I don't think he can translate his 2020 form into sort of a full 10 over spell in an ODI. We've already kind of seen him do it a couple of times, but I would like to see him play these last two games. You know, however confident they are that he is going to be in the final squad, just give him that time. You know, you talk about batsman time at the crease. Bowlers need time coming to the crease as well.
You know, he's bowled fewer than 100 deliveries in international cricket, which is absolutely staggering for a guy who is now going to, we think, supplant someone out of the squad. Now, whoever he replaces will probably feel unlucky. Is it going to be a fast bowler, first of all?
Has to be, yeah, because first and foremost, you go, well, there were 15 named initially. Alex Hales drops out. You have to replace him with a batsman because Joe Denley isn't, I don't think, up to it, batting at the top of the order, even if just as a replacement, and he's not had the time in the middle otherwise to prove that he's in great form. So I think we have to bring in James Vince. it has to be a fast bowler, because even if there are question marks over Denley, I do think you want a third spinner option in there, because if Adil Rashid or Moeen Ali were to get injured or ill, if our whole success has been based on 20 overs of spin in nearly every game, then you wouldn't want to go into a big World Cup game without that option. So it has to be at the expense of a fast bowler, and I think increasingly it's coming down to a choice of being between one of three fast bowlers particularly, and for me those are probably David Willey, Mark Wood and Tom Curran. And I personally know who I think it is who I would leave out. It's a very, very tough call.
No Liam Plunkett in that list.
No, I think Liam Plunkett stays in because, one, I've been quite encouraged by how he's bowled in the couple of games for England. Although he had a couple of bad games for Surrey at the very start of the one-day season, he actually had a couple of good ones before the England games got underway. He's a guy as well that has made those middle overs his niche. I think it's dangerous to, in the same way that it would be dangerous to discard the spin options, it'd be dangerous to discard someone who has made himself so reliable and so valuable in those middle overs. I don't think we've got anyone that does it better, to be quite honest, and I've not seen his pace drop enough to make me think that he's losing it just yet. Maybe the World Cup, whichever game is our last, will be Plunkett's last for England, but I don't think this is the right moment to discard him, personally.
So the three are Tom Curran, David Willey,
and Mark Wood. And
now,
I think Mark
Wood seems like a surprise because he obviously had that amazing test match spell over in the West Indies and is quick.
Well, I'd say two things. I'd say, one, he hasn't bowled all season in England since that West Indies tour where he kind of re-announced himself on the international stage. That is, first and foremost, a concern. They've talked about how he's going to probably play the last two games, how the fourth game was always the target match. But unfortunately, a lot of other players have kind of put themselves forward already. He's got catching up to do. So short of him blitzing a team and, you know, knowing the sort of thing that normally happens when I make predictions, he will now go and do this. But I say two things. I say, A, not as quick as Archer. And Archer is such a good athlete. His fitness record is so good. I don't have worries in the same way that you do with Mark Wood about him, you know, going over on an ankle or pulling up or whatever it might be. Wood, we know, has had long-standing injury concerns. I think Archer should be able to play every game. Do you need them both? I'm not so sure. You know, we like the left arm option of David Willey. If the ball is swinging, he'll be able to swing it. And as for Tom Curran, I do think, I was reminded watching him yesterday, he is very, very good at producing those variations at the death. He hits a Yorker probably better than any of our other bowlers, other than Archer perhaps. And again, I think that losing his variations and his confidence, you know, I know that Ben Stokes, and actually his bowling is a little bit of an issue, to be fair, at the moment, but he likes the responsibility of final overs. But I think given what happened in the World 2020 final and then in the IPL a few weeks ago, he's not going to get any more of them. We need people who want to bowl those final overs. And Tom Curran, young as he may be, is one of those guys.
So, you're the England selector. You're required to drop someone for Jofra Archer. Who is it?
Mark Wood. Mark Wood's Tino Asprey prediction is going to come back to bite him a little bit, I'm afraid. And I say that with regret because I actually really like Mark Wood. But my other concern would be, I think Mark Wood is more important to us in Test cricket as it stands, because Jofra Archer is completely unproven there. He may not be by the end of the summer.
He's completely unproven in international cricket, full stop. He's bowled 96 deliveries in international cricket. You can't say he's unproven in Test cricket and then say, but he's good at ODI.
He's unproven at international level, but he has been performing at such a good level in white ball cricket around the world that you could be pretty confident he was going to do the same. The red ball, it's a little bit different. I know he's done well for Sussex too in that format. I'm not denying that. I'm just saying it's another step up that we haven't seen him do any of yet.
He's got a test out. He's got a first class average of 23, by the way. That's clearly not good enough.
I'm not saying he's not a good red ball bowler. I'm saying that as it stands, Wood is that first choice to be our outright quick bowler in red ball cricket. And I want him fit for the Ashes. And I would worry that, given his injury history, if he plays a lot at the World Cup, he may break down at some point during the Ashes. He may anyway. He may not if he plays all summer. You don't know. You can't tell with these things, but I would suggest he's less likely to if he's played a little bit less international cricket in the build-up to it. So I'd say, Mark, I'm very sorry. Go away. Get yourself in absolute peak condition. Come back firing for the Ashes and bowl like you did out in St. Lucia in England in August and September.
If Mark was listening, I'm sure he'll take that right to heart. Fortunately, Guy Watts is not the selector. Owen Morgan, we should touch on this a little bit,
yes,
because he's been suspended for the fourth ODI in their warm-up series. Of course, he's so short of form that will really frustrate him. He's only averaging, I think, 120 in the last year?
I think it's slightly lower than that, James. You're getting carried away. It's around 100 since last July in one-day internationals. Quite remarkable. Another few not-out runs to add to that yesterday coming in and and polishing off at the end with some lusty hitting. He, yes, will be suspended, so you would assume that Jos Buttler will not just come back into the team, will also be captain. He's vice-captain, of course, in this format. A bit of tactics, perhaps?
Because he way this works, right, is that if you consistently have slow over rates, the penalties sort of go up and up and up.
It's a sort of demerit point system, and this was a second offence within 12 months. The first one's a fine, the second one's a one-match ban for the captain. All the players, it should be noted, were fined 20% of their match fees for being part of the slow over rate. And I would say, actually, that we could be a little bit blasé about this. I think that England have been quite guilty of this over the last few years, and as brilliant as a lot of their cricket's been, particularly their batting in one-day cricket, you should be playing this game quickly. It's supposed to be a dynamic game, a game played at speed. It's supposed to keep the spectators interested. It's not good enough. You know, it's one thing for it to happen in Test cricket where, you know, it's over a kind of a five-day period. It's understandable if the energy levels drop a little bit. In one-day cricket, it shouldn't be like that. There shouldn't be much of an excuse for not getting through your overs. Hopefully, this one-day suspension is the last we hear of it this summer. It's a wake-up call to Morgan and the rest of the players, and there's no more of this nonsense. Because as nice a day as it was at Bristol yesterday, actually, you don't want to feel like you're having the mitt taken out of you. You don't want to be sitting there for 5 minutes between overs thinking, what on earth is going on?
Yeah, and this is the whole thing about cricket at the moment. It's trying to make it quicker. I mean, I played a format a couple of weeks ago in the Surrey Slam, which is basically they bowl 10 overs from one end and 10 overs from the other end in an effort to make cricket faster. Now, I hated it because I'm a traditionalist and it felt wrong, but it did. We absolutely rattled through
there
the game.
Go.
It was a 20-over game. We were done by 8 o'clock. We started at 6, and that's great. That's how it should be. I've always said you should be able to bowl 20 overs in an hour anyway, but that's neither here nor there. Owen Morgan, I'm sure, will appreciate the day off, because England's batting lineup, well, they don't feel like they need him at the moment.
Love Sport.
Now, Aston Villa were beaten 1-0 at West Brom last night. It pushed the game all the way to penalties in the Championship playoff semi-final. And it was Villa who kept their cool, despite Albert Adoma blazing one over the crossbar to reach Wembley for the second year in a row. Now, we've got former Aston Villa defender on the line, Tony DiRigo. Tony, how are your nerves this morning?
Yeah, shredded. Simple as that. Some of these games are crazy, aren't they? You know it means so much. That's the thing. You've got some really big clubs involved, and they all want to get to the Premier League, and you know, they can't all do it. So, Aston Villa is my first club. Really good to see that they got through last night, but my goodness, they certainly made it difficult.
Yeah, going to the Hawthorns, I mean, it was an electric atmosphere, obviously, and it was great to see. There's something about those games that is so rarefied. Do you think Aston Villa were a little bit intimidated by it? Because, obviously, they lost 1-0 and West Brom had 10 men for, 10 minutes of normal time and then half an hour of extra time.
Yeah, I think, I'm not sure intimidated. I think certainly the atmosphere does play a huge part, you know, absolutely. I think the fans, certainly West Brom fans, understand how important it was to, you know, support their side as best they can. And they did a magnificent job, you know, to try to will their side on. And the players for West Brom gave absolutely everything. So you have to remember they were, you know, a decent Premier League outfit. They got relegated, had plenty of money. They spent it a little bit in January as well. So they're bound to be a problem for Villa. So it's never was going to be easy. But I thought that couple of minutes spell in that first leg for Villa was vital. And they always looked like they could nick a goal from somewhere. But it was so close, and in the end it was just a penalty miss that did it.
Jack Grealish, I thought, had another decent game, although McGinn does so much legwork for him. How impressed have you been with Grealish this year? And do you think, even if Villa don't go up, that he'll be in the Premier League next season?
Well, actually, I think you mentioned that there about McGinn, in that it's the balance at the side. You know, allows Grealish to then, obviously, he's the one they want to get on the ball in the dangerous areas and make things happen. And he's been, very, very good. Obviously, the most fouled player for a reason. Because if you let him play, he's going to cause you problems. But McGinn does so much work alongside him. Just, amazing. He's like a Duracell bunny, ever ready. Just goes everywhere, but allows then, I think, the best to certainly get out of Grealish.
Do you think having a player like McGinn in the side, I don't know if you've played with someone who you know is going to, A, give their all on every occasion, and I know there's a lot of players like that, but also has that kind of stamina. It must give the whole team a feeling of confidence and, just a little bit more in the later stages of a game.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think you always look to, to certain players, and whether it's a vocal leader, whether it's someone that leads by his actions, or whether it's, like a McGinn that just charges around and gives you so much energy to feed off of, it's really important to have those sorts of players. So, certainly McGinn is one of those. I think in your side, you'd absolutely love him. Playing against him, he'd be a pain in the bum, wouldn't he?
Yeah.
Stops.
I mean, playing against a midfielder, John McGinn and Jack Grealish, you know, it's which way, which poison do you prefer, frankly? Obviously, you mentioned it was a penalty shootout at the end. It's never a nice way to solve these things, but sometimes it is the only way. Did you have an inkling, you know, before the shootout, did you look at it and think, I think Villa have got this, or maybe West Brom will edge it?
No, I have experience of these myself, and what I do know is anything can happen. It's a horrible thing that the walk from the halfway line to the penalty spot is one of the longest in football. So many thoughts then go through your head. And as you say, there's no other way of kind of, you know, sorting it out. They were level over 180 minutes or more. 210. So it's painful. There's always going to be a hero and a villain. Normally it's the keepers that come out on top in this occasion. But yeah, as you mentioned it there, Adoma missing didn't matter so much. And even Abraham's, to be fair, penalty at the end, still got a little nick on the way through. But you know what? It doesn't matter. Ended up in the back of the net. The elation was evident. Although, you know, you have to kind of tone that down by nothing's done yet, because there's still a huge game to go. Mm.
Well, you obviously weren't involved, but you were on hand in that 1990 shootout with England, weren't you?
Yes, I was, and actually, I was. If I got on the pitch, I was going to take a penalty.
Oh, were you?
But Robson, yeah, told me beforehand, which didn't really settle my nerves any. But
that's quite a weird. I've not heard that before. Managers saying, if we get to a shootout, you're on a penalty. Was that normal?
Yeah, I don't think so. But I think it's more a case he was coming around to see who was confident, you know, who would want to take one. Mm. And obviously, with my left foot, I would take one. So, I immediately said yes. But so then you sit down and think, okay, what have I just said then?
Yeah, what have I signed up for here?
Yeah, exactly. What have I signed up for there?
Well, you know what, Tony? If you had got on and taken one, history might be very, very different. That could have been the sliding doors moment in English football history. We'll never know.
Well, you are quite right. Or I could have cleared row Z, just like the other boys. Kicked it even further in the stand. Who knows?
No, quite possibly. Obviously, Villa are through to the final now. They'll face either Leeds or Derby, and of course another one of your former clubs in Leeds. Who do you think at this point of the three clubs is favourite to go up?
Oh, that is so difficult. I certainly think Leeds, by the performance at Derby, was really impressive. I think the best of best football of the three, I think if Leeds can produce it, they will go up, but whether they can produce it is the question, isn't it? So I think Leeds will go through against Derby. We Leeds Villa. That should be a cracking game. And unfortunately, I do remember a game, Leeds Villa in a cup final many, many moons ago, that I unfortunately did not take place in, because I pulled my hamstring on the morning of the game and missed out, and Villa went on to win the cup 3-0. So it was one of the worst days for me as a player, and couldn't do anything about it. But I'm sure this game will be hopefully a bit different. And I do fancy Leeds. I think they produce their best. I think Leeds will win.
Do you think that dip in form late in the season compares, you know, complete opposite of Aston Villa? And of course, Villa last year ran into Fulham, who were on a similar run of wins at the end of the season. Do you think form does play into these playoffs, or does it go out the window? Is it like a cup final, they say?
I really do believe it does go out the window. Simply because it's very difficult to maintain your form over a long period of time. Villa have done fantastic, and what a run they've come on. And everyone says it's the team with the run that goes up. But if you look at the stats, that's not necessarily true. And I think also you have to then look at what happened to Leeds, in that they were first or second for huge parts of the season. The disappointment of that Wigan game was palpable. I mean, it was incredible. I was there. It was the players were absolutely devastated. And it took them a little game or two to get over it. And I think actually when they played Villa at Elland Road, you could see that they were kind of back at it. But I thought the game against Derby, they certainly were back at it. And the important games, they normally certainly turn up and then play very, very well. So I think if you're looking at, I'd say, the best of each side, I think Leeds get it for me. But you've got to produce it. So anything can happen, absolutely anything.
Marcelo Bielsa, of course, we all kind of want to see. And I was talking to a Tottenham fan this morning. He says, I'm desperate to see Pochettino versus Bielsa again, just because of the storied history and their relationship. What have you made of Marcelo Bielsa? What can you make of Marcelo Bielsa this year?
Oh, what can I say about that man there? A revelation.
Yeah.
For the club, he's turned it inside out, and changed the perception, the fans, the style, everything. What he's done is quite remarkable. But I think, more to the point, it's the type of person that he is. He seems extremely humble. You know, I had so many stories of people seeing him just with a shopping bag, you know, walking back from Sainsbury's or Tesco's, wherever it is, back to his apartment. He walks from the training ground and back, and it's just amazing, you know, wearing his Leeds tracksuit. It's chucking it down with the rain. It doesn't matter. He's just walking along the road. I mean, I don't know. He's a throwback. He believes in a certain style and way of playing, which is wonderful, but has full belief, and he carries the players and fans, you know, on with it. I think the style that we've seen at Elland Road certainly is the best in, you know, 15, 20 years. You know, absolutely, there's no doubt about that. And Howie's produced better football from what largely is the same players that finished 14th or 15th last season. Mm. It's quite remarkable. And I think when you talk about managers, a lot of managers in this day and age, you know, they want a budget of 30, 40 million, 100 million, whatever it is, to change the team. Well, he came in, said none of that. He says, I'm going to work with these players. These are the ones that I want, and I'm going to make them better. I think that's refreshing as well.
Just finally, Tony, I have to ask you about the other dugout, because Frank Lampard, of course, is in his first management season. Do you think this is the beginning of his journey to Chelsea manager? Because it could have been he went a bit Paul Merson or John Barnes or whoever it happened to be and had a complete flop at Derby, but he's done okay. Do you think that this probably confirms that one day he will be Chelsea manager? It feels inevitable at this point.
I think he's done probably more than okay, because Derby clearly with their financial issues, he couldn't keep all their best players. And what he has done, I think, has been really good. Again, the style, I really do like. I suppose the only thing I would say certainly is in the games against Leeds is that we're waiting for a plan B or a way to unlock the Leeds side of Derby. Certainly seems to be struggling with that conundrum. So Frank's got a bit of work to do there. But I certainly think he's done tremendously well. And you're right, more experience, he will learn and learn and learn. And you can see the type of a man that he is. You know, he will get there. He is determined. I think he's going to be a Chelsea manager one day, and he's well on the way to doing that.
Tony, thank you so much for joining us. Good luck tonight. You have a team to support almost every day this week, so I imagine your nerves are going to be completely shredded.
I'm very confused, I have to say.
The final will be a nightmare if it's Leeds Villa. Who will you support if it's Leeds Villa?
That's a tough one, but I will go for Leeds, I have to say. I think, I'm now back in Leeds.
I was going to say, you're based up there, aren't you? So it's probably a sensible and safe choice.
Yeah. Although Villa did give me my chance in football, I've got to say, my happiest and winning memories, I suppose, are at Leeds.
Brilliant. Tony, thank you so much, as always. That's Tony Dorigo, former Leeds and Aston Villa defender there.
Love sport.
We're doing our very own awards here on the James Gray Show. We released our first one yesterday, the Most Valuable Player Award, the MVP. If you want to have your say on these awards, you can head over to @LoveSportRadio on Twitter. We're running our first poll from yesterday. The Most Valuable Player in the Premier League. Which player? It matters the most to their team. Is it Wilfried Zaha, Glenn Murray, Eden Hazard or Lucas Fabianski? Today, we're going to do a little bit of the best newcomer. We're looking at a Best Newcomer Award. Who's been your most impressive breakthrough player in the Premier League this season? We've got as nominees Aaron Wan-Bissaka at Crystal Palace, David Brooks at Bournemouth, Lucas Torreira at Arsenal and Raul Jimenez at Wolves, of course, after their brilliant season. And now to talk a little bit about the relative merits of Raul Jimenez on the line, we've got a Wolves legend in Jody Craddock. Good afternoon, Jody. How are you getting on?
Very good, thank you. Very good.
Good. Great to speak to you, as always. As you will have heard there, we've got Raul Jimenez up for our Best Newcomer in the Premier League Award this season. He's been absolutely massive for Wolves. What have you made of him for a guy playing his first season in the Premier League, remember?
Yeah. He's done brilliant. The Premiership is a really, really difficult place to play. As an English player, you kind of know how difficult it is because it's there, it's in your face all the time. But, he's come from abroad and he's come in and he's settled in quickly. I think he's got 14 goals and it's a tough place to play and it's a hard division to score goals in. And he's come in and he's done good. He's done fantastic. The whole team have, as a whole. But, he's been standout. And to score goals like that, I think to become the top goal scorer for Wolves in the in any Premiership season, it's been a great achievement for him.
As a defender yourself, were there times, especially early season, when you came up and you thought, oh, they've just bought this lad for 20 million quid from Spain, think I might let him know I'm there early on? Or was that just everyone?
All the time. That was me. I'd be thinking, right, is he playing? Right, there is, you know, if it's a player and it's their top man, it's the centre forward, and they've spent a fortune, you're thinking, oh, yeah, I've got my work cut out here. It, as a defender, it kind of encourages you to play even tougher than maybe than you usually would. But, yeah, there's no easy, like I said, there's no easy games in the Premiership. Every forward seems to be 20, 30 million. It's difficult. So as a defender, yeah, you've got to be on your game, and I suppose that is part of the Premiership, and that's part of, you know, the love of it. It's why it's, for me, the best division in the world.
And how glad were you to see Wolves nail down Jimenez? Obviously, he'd been on loan this season, but they paid a club record £30 million for him. Yeah. Value for money at that, do you think?
Everybody, you know, everyone's expensive. It's a lot of money. It is. It's most of the club has spent, but well worth it. When you've got a player that gives you 14 goals a season, you know, hopefully he'll score more next season. So when you have that, that's what you need. You know, you need players to turn out and score goals, and that's how you stay in the Premiership. And he's done that. He's done fantastic. So definitely, you know, good news for the Wolves to get that done and dust and get it sorted before pre-season, before everything starts kicking off again. And to get it done early.
Yeah, get business done early, always the best way to do it. Wolves, of course, we've also got Wolves up for Team of the Year in our awards, actually, because 7th place as a promoted side is absolutely brilliant. They're only, in the end, 9 points behind Manchester United, although they're a mid-table side these days as well. how were you surprised that Wolves have done as well as they have?
Yeah, I'm not going to lie, I am surprised. I think I'd have said half the table at the start of the season, you know, but as a newly promoted team, it's always, right, let's go for, you know, go for survival. Let's, you know, put our base down, make sure we don't get relegated. I think they've surpassed everybody's kind of expectations, maybe not the manager's expectations. You know, maybe he knew that's how good they were. We knew they were good from the last season. But you never know going into the Premiership. You just don't know because it's that tough a division. And they've been fantastic. And, you know, waiting on Man City in the FA Cup, they could be in Europa next season, which, wow, what a fantastic feat that would be for the Wolves and the fans and everybody involved around the city.
In terms of going forward, you know, I talk about how they're only 9 points behind Manchester United. Do you think Wolves can realistically dream of breaking into that top six and becoming one of the big boys again?
I can't see why not. You know, it does involve a lot of money because you need to spend big, and that's what teams do. And they buy, you get the big players, but you need to start somewhere. And by finishing 7th in the Premiership, which is a fantastic achievement, people just open their eyes a little bit and think, well, hold on. You know, if you approach a big player, they're not going to turn your nose down. They're going to have a look and see what's on the table, and they know how well Wolves have done. And, you know, that finishing 7th is a real big bonus for the club because people will just start to stop and have a look. And, you know, you just don't know, do you? You just don't know where the club can go and what it can achieve.
And just finally, Jody, obviously summer coming up. As you mentioned, we've already got Raul Jimenez signed on for £30 million. Are there any other areas of this Wolves team which you look at and think we could do with another player here or there?
Do you know what? I've been thinking this. And I can't, it's one of them, I can't, they've been, because they've surpassed expectations, they've finished in 7th, you kind of look and think, wow, that team's done great, that team should be starting next season, that, you know, they've done brilliant. If you are in the Europa, you may possibly need to strengthen your squad. God forbid you have a couple of injuries, especially with your two front men. I don't know, do you need another backup up front to just in case there's an injury? Possibly, maybe.
It says a lot about how well put together the squad is, though, that you have to sit here and go, really don't know what areas they can improve on, frankly.
I agree. You know, if you bring a player in and he's an expensive player, he's going to want to play, isn't he? So then it's a juggling act. Or do you bring a player in to kind of sit and wait on the bench if someone gets injured you know, be there just in case. So it's a real fine line for the manager of getting that balance right and keeping players happy that aren't quite in the team or, you know, that type of scenario.
Who'd be a football manager, eh? Nightmare stuff. Jody, thank
you. Exactly. Who'd be one, not
me. No, quite. Thank you so much for coming on, as always. Pleasure to speak to you. Absolute Wolves legend there, Jody Craddock. And I think he's quite right. It's very hard to look at that Wolves squad and go, oh, yes, they do need to improve here because Yeah, they've been lucky in that, for the most part, touch wood, they've not had many injuries. They've been able to keep the squad together. Really, it's about depth now. The overall quality is there. Think about what they did to top six teams last year. If they had beat Huddersfield home and away, they'd be right up Man United's backside. Not a pleasant place to be, I admit.
Love Sport.
Now, let's speak to someone who knows Leeds United pretty well this year. It's football journalist John McKenzie, because he's writing a book about Marcelo Bielsa. It's a shame you're writing a book this year, John, because it's been pretty uneventful for Bielsa, hasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. I don't know how I'm going to scrape enough words together about this year.
Quite remarkable. Did you plan to write this book before he'd even started his antics?
Yeah, so as soon as the rumours came out that he was coming, I managed to get a little bit of ITK and was pretty sure he was coming before they made the formal announcement. As soon as I knew that, I was already planning in my head the way that the book was going to go.
And as I say, you couldn't have asked for a better year, realistically. A lot of people say they've been fans of Bielsa. Your previous knowledge of him, did you expect that it would be a pretty fireworks-heavy season?
Yeah, I think so. He's an interesting guy. For me, he's the most interesting guy in world football at the moment, because he just thinks in such a unique and interesting way. So I was pretty sure that we were going to see a side of football that we hadn't seen that much in the Championship before. And I just thought, you know, that the balance between Bielsa being the individual that he is and the narrative that Leeds United have was just going to be dynamite for a book. So, and it's proved to be that way, fortunately.
What have you made of Bielsa, having studied him up a bit close and personal than perhaps you previously have? Has he been everything you expected in terms of his idiosyncrasies and, well, frankly, slight madness?
Yeah, entirely. And I think the thing that about Bielsa that makes him so fascinating is the fact that he is quite ponderous about the way that football works, not just as a sport, not just about the mechanics and tactics of the game, but about the sort of social impact of the game as well. And I think one of the reasons why perhaps he isn't remembered as being quite as great as he perhaps will do in the future is because we think of football very much in terms of its of it as a game rather than as a social determinant. So it's been really fascinating. His post pre and post match interviews are just so, they have so much depth to them. There's so much careful thought to them, and it's made me think about the game in a whole new way as well.
Following Leeds as well, of course, one of the great clubs of English football. You know, a lot of history there and a lot of idiosyncrasies themselves. Have you been impressed with how Bielsa and Leeds have kind of meshed together?
Yeah, entirely. So this is a squad that finished 13th last season, and there's really not been a huge amount of additions to that squad. So he's got this team playing at a level 10 places higher than they were playing at last season, which is fairly impressive. Mm. For me, I think it's this idea that he has of the collective. There's a famous lecture he gave at the Amsterdam Arena for an Aspire conference, where he talks about the way that in football we focus predominantly on elite players. The players who can do things really well already, and we don't think so much about the average players who can't do the same sorts of things. And this season's just been a real testament to that idea that he has worked really hard in getting the most out of players who we might not think of as being as important to the team, and they've really shone. So it's been amazing to see that sort of unfold.
Obviously, the Spygate saga has perhaps been the most public of Bielsa-isms. What was your view of it? How did you come across it, and again, were you surprised that this is something Bielsa did? Were you aware of it before?
Yeah, so there's plenty of stories of him doing similar things in the past in various clubs that he's been to. He did used to the stories of him sending interns up trees to watch training sessions and stuff. So I wasn't particularly surprised about the fact that he had people going along to watch training sessions. In many respects, I think he was quite frustrated because it was all played out as a sort of big moral problem, and I think he thinks that there's more pressing moral problems in football than whether or not someone is sending someone to go to public space and watch another team train. But I think he took it very personally, this idea that he was doing this knowing that he was cheating, and so for me that there's a real fascinating insight into that whole saga. Was just a fascinating insight into the way that he thinks through what is and isn't appropriate and issues of morality and ethics. But I think if you were to push him, he would say, yeah, you know, there's bigger ethical problems in football that we just let go all the time. And case in point is the game against Aston Villa when essentially Leeds not kicking the ball out of play was deemed to be worse than both teams just emptying out and starting a fight. So,
Do you think he allowed that goal partly because of what had gone on with Spygate? That seems to be quite a popular narrative.
I think that's interesting, but I don't, that he is simply sort of making the situation work for himself ethically, I think is unfair to him, because I think he is a guy who is true to his word. He's like the ultra idealist. He knows what he thinks about things and how things should be done. And I don't think he's the sort of person who would think, well, given that this has already happened, this has now become the right thing for me to do. I think he thinks it's the right thing to do. I suspect he would have probably lain awake at night thinking, if they hadn't have given Villa that goal, well, we didn't really win. Like, it's not really winning if you score a goal that is not really in the best interest of the game. So that's the sort of man that he is. He has clear ideas about what is right and wrong, and a very black and white views on that. So I suspect that he would have done that had Spygate happened or not.
And do you think he'll get Leeds promoted this season? The million-dollar question.
I think Leeds will get to the playoff finals. I think from there on, it's anyone's game. But he's done everything that was asked of him. I think no Leeds fan has anything negative to say about Bielsa. The way that the team has played has been thoroughly entertaining. It's been thoroughly enjoyable to watch. It's been the sort of tactical football that we haven't seen at Elland Road in a long time. So I think there's you know, missing out the final hurdle will be disappointing, but I think there'll be a realisation that if Bielsa stays next season, it'll be more of the same. And Leeds will be favourites to go up automatically next season with a bit of investment, I think.
Next season as well, I mean, one of my best mates is a Tottenham fan. He's been talking to me about how excited he is that Leeds might come up, because he wants to see Bielsa and Pochettino meet on the touchline again, and the possibility of that relationship. I mean, Poch basically says he is his teacher, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So he picked up Pochettino very, very early when he was at Newell's Old Boys, and had him at the Argentina national side and Espanyol as well for a very brief period. Yeah, it's interesting, the question of legacy. Like, what does the genealogy of managers look like? Because if you actually compare Pochettino and Bielsa, they're quite different individuals, and their management styles are very different as well. But I think, you know, there's a clear sense that there's a certain way that the game should be played. And I think Bielsa is probably a bit more idealistic. He's very much not a plan B type player, whereas Pochettino clearly has that sort of more pragmatic side to him as well. But there is very clear overlaps there. But yeah, I hear this from so many people, you know, this idea that, oh, I'd love to see Leeds in the Premier League again. Love to see Bielsa in the Premier League. So I think there's a lot of people out there actually quite invested in the results of this playoff.
Yeah, there's a lot of people very sort of conflicted, because they hate Leeds, because apparently if you're over the age of 25, you have to hate Leeds. But also the desire to see them back. John, thank you so much for joining us. Fascinating to hear someone who's basically been stalking Marcelo Bielsa for the last year. And good luck with the rest of the book. And I hope Bielsa gets promoted, because it would, of course, make things even better for you. John McKenzie there, football journalist. He's writing a book about Marcelo Bielsa's first year in English football. And it has been a fascinating one, because he is one of the most interesting people in world football. Ian Holloway, big friend of the station, guy who comes on a lot, absolutely idealises Marcelo Bielsa. Now, there's a friendship I don't think you would have thought you'd hear today.
Love sports.
Let's move on, because I'm angry about something else. It does happen. Serie A recently returned a series of disciplinary hearings. Why are you telling us this, James? Why are you telling us this? They haven't even taken any action. It's true. They've taken no action against Cagliari, which I suppose you might think ordinarily is not particularly interesting. But it is regarding the incident which saw Moise Keane score in a game for Juventus against Cagliari, and then celebrate holding his ears, cupping his ears and saying, I can't hear you, essentially, because they had spent, it was alleged, the whole game making monkey noises at him, among other racist chants, apparently. And Serie A have investigated it and decided not to sanction it, not to sanction the club or the fans or any of it. The quote is, it emerged the chants in question, although certainly reprehensible, had an objectively limited relevance to race. Excuse me? It's either racist or it's not. This is not a sliding scale. You don't get to give something a racist rating out of 10. Either a chant is racist or it's not. And this approach to say, oh, it's a bit borderline, a bit of a grey area, this, is absolutely bizarre. It, at best, by the way, it's strange at best. At worst, it's actually almost encouraging racism. And I'm absolutely blown away, but I'm also not surprised, because it seems to me that the Italian league, more than any other league, is one where racism seems to keep coming up. Players keep threatening to walk off. But also, the other theme that seems to be redeveloping in Italian football, or constantly re-emerging, is authorities not understanding the problem and not even acknowledging the problem. You know, players getting booked or even sent off for complaining to the referee about racist chanting. Teams not getting sanctioned. Fines being handed out. And look, I'm not going to sit here and say that we're perfect in this country. I know we're not. But the problem is that no one is perfect on this. And the Italians, it seems, the Italian football authorities are some of the least perfect. Now, they haven't got much of an example, have they, from UEFA? The people who once fined Porto £16,000 for racist chanting against Manchester City, and a month later fined Sporting Lisbon £30,000 for coming out onto the pitch 30 seconds late. That's the kind of body we're dealing with on a European level. So I'm not saying that Serie A are the only people who fail to deal with racism. But frankly, this is absolutely baffling that Serie A have said, they've admitted, this is almost the worst bit of it. They've said, yeah, the chanting question, certainly reprehensible, although it had an objectively limited relevance to race. Now that suggests that they were still related to race to an extent, even if it was limited. I'm sorry, racism is, for want of a better phrase, black and white. It either is or it isn't, and you can't create a sliding scale. What you're doing there is creating wiggle room. What you're doing is creating areas for the racists, who will defend their racism, to do so. You're creating margins where they can go, oh, well, it was a bit borderline, actually. Is this really racist? And that's the kind of encroachment that leads to more and more racism. And frankly, is how so many different regimes which institutionalized racism started. It's a thin end of the wedge thing. They started by making little incursions against certain types of people. And then all of a sudden, when you make the next jump, it doesn't feel so bad. And you go further and further and further until you start completely marginalizing certain sects of society. I'm not saying that's what's going to happen, but it's certainly what Serie A's failure to deal with this problem might start to feel like. England isn't perfect. Europe isn't perfect. But when these things come up, you have to say, that's not fair. And remember that Serie A aren't even the only people who criticised Moise Keane's treatment of it. His own manager, Max Allegri, said he shouldn't have celebrated in that manner. He's a young man, he has to learn, but certain things for the crowd also shouldn't be heard. Italy international Leonardo Bonucci said, I think the blame is 50-50. Have you ever seen so much institutionalised victim blaming than this? And I don't want to sound like a social justice warrior. I don't think I'm being one. But when you're admitting that there was an element of racism to the chanting, and then you're still failing to sanction the club involved, what message does that send to all the black footballers in Italy and indeed around the world?
Love Sport.
They are fights we do really want to see, frankly. Like, we've already seen Fury Wilder, and it was a great fight. Sure, the decision might have been wrong. The draw might not have been the right thing. But do you think we will ever see Fury versus Joshua? I'm starting to think we might not, because they are so far away from fighting each other. They're not even really talking about it anymore. They say, oh yeah, I'd fight him and I'd beat him. But they're not really saying, yeah, all right, let's get it on. When are we going to do it? And that's what we want to see. I don't understand these heavyweights who constantly avoid these big fights, because honestly, Tyson Fury could fight Anthony Joshua every day for the rest of his life, and I'd watch it. So why, obviously that's unrealistic, and so why won't they just fight every year? I would watch Joshua Fury. I'd pay £40 to watch Joshua Fury every day for a week. Honestly, it's madness that they won't. The one fight that looks like it might happen is Tyson Fury versus Dillian Whyte, but Fury is being awkward about it. The WBC have ordered a final eliminator for the right to face Deontay Wilder, the WBC champion, between Fury and Whyte. It'd be a great all-British fight, I don't know who would win. I think probably Fury, but I'm not sure. Interesting matchup. And they've both said they want to do it. Fury said on Instagram, "I accept the challenge. I'll fight Dylan White every day of the week." As he's heard there, he says he'll fight almost anyone anytime. And Dylan White responded on Twitter, said, "Let's do it. I'll fight you anytime, anywhere." So they're happy to do it at any point and in any place. So let's just get it done, shall we? Excellent. Jobs are good and fine. Of course it won't happen like that. And Fury has said that this fight, he said, "Oh, I saw recently they said this fight is going to be for the interim title. Thanks for the opportunity. But what I suggest, because I beat Deontay Wilder and we all know what happened, I didn't get the decision. But I still won and the world knows. I propose we make me and Dylan White for the WBC Diamond Belt and not the interim belt." Now, the Diamond Belt is it's a ceremonial belt that essentially the WBC created for historic fights. I believe the McGregor-Mayweather fight, for example, was one that they gave the WBC Diamond notification to. Look, there are a lot of belts in boxing. I think this is Fury being awkward and being a bit arrogant because he believes he's the true champion and he wants something to show for it. Why not just get in the ring and show us you're the true champion? If you are the true champion, why wouldn't you just go in and say, "Right, I am the champion, so I'll just beat Dylan White and then it doesn't matter"? If he did that, no one would argue with it. If he went out against Dylan White in September at Wembley, because that's the kind of fight this could be, no one would say, "Oh, well, that's ridiculous. How can he say he's the champion?" If he went out and, you know, beat Dylan White in a unanimous decision or knocked him out in 10 rounds. This is the problem. Boxing isn't about talking. It's about boxing. It's about fighting. So show us that you are a fighting man. Tyson Fury always says, "Oh, I'm a fighting man. I give him a boxing lesson. I'm a fighting man." Show us you're a fighting man, because at the moment, you're a talking man. It is a fighting sport, and that's what people want to see. It's what people pay to see. What people don't pay to see is what Deontay Wilder is talking about. And not for the first time, he's talked about killing someone in a ring. I almost don't want to say it, because it's a horrible thought. Absolutely horrible thought. More recent, we've heard him previously say that he has this alter ego who he calls the Bronze Bomber. And I remember him doing an interview where he said, "Oh, the bomber wants a body. The bomber wants a body on his record." I.e., he wants to kill someone. And again, he has said, "This is the only sport where you can kill a man and get paid for it at the same time. It's legal." I mean, that is absolutely reprehensible. Honestly. You know, Anthony Bellew, one of the most respected fighters in the UK at the moment, he always says, before every fight, he just said, "You know, I just want to come home and see my kids, get home safe." I have no doubt Deontay Wilder is doing this for attention, which is fine. But there is a line, Deontay, and that is way over it. You want to meet, I don't know, Edward Goodneck's wife, who is still alive but living in a life-altered state after fighting George Groves. She posts her bank details on interviews because they are so broke from having adapted their home to Edward's disability after a brain injury during a fight. There are countless people who've died in the boxing ring. Does Deontay Wilder want to add another one to the record? Does Deontay Wilder actually want to kill someone in the boxing ring? He told Dominic Brazil, his next opponent, to make some funeral arrangements. Does Deontay Wilder actually live in a world where this is acceptable? Because if so, I think we should ban him from boxing. If he's going to stand up, and he's done it twice now, and say, "I want to kill someone in the ring," I think he should be banned from boxing. It's completely unacceptable. And I don't understand why anyone is tolerating him in this sport.
This is Love Sport.
You've been listening to the James Gray Show podcast edition. Please do leave us a rating and a review wherever you get your podcasts. And remember, you can listen to the show live on Love Sport Radio every weekday from 1 p.m. until 3:30.